Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this evening's event at the LSE. My name is Tina Farm. I'm a director in a consulting firm and a governor here at the LSE. It's my absolute pleasure to welcome Sarah Ooten to the LSE today. Sarah is an adventurer, motivational speaker, and author. Going to share with you a very small extract from Sarah's profile. Rowing solo across oceans, cycling through deserts, and kayaking treacherous islands, British adventurer Sarah Ooten has done it all. From the moment she started her first major expedition, which saw her row solo across the Indian Ocean when she was just 24 years old, Sarah was hooked and wanted more. Her latest challenge was an epic undertaking and saw her take 4.5 years to row, kayak, and cycle around the Northern Hemisphere. From London to London, a journey of some 25,000 miles. Tonight, Sarah will be speaking about her new book, Dare to Do. It's a story of the kindness of strangers and the spirit of travel. A story of the raw power of nature, of finding love in unexpected places and discovering your inner strength. It's about trying and failing and trying again, and about how, even when all seems lost, you can still find yourself. For Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is LSE Dare to Do. I would ask if you would please put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt this evening's event. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be available on a podcast, subject to there being no technical difficulties. As usual, after the lecture, there'll be a chance for you to ask Sarah questions. There will also be a book signing taking place following the event, and copies of Sarah's book will be available for sale. So for now, all that remains is for me to ask you to please join me in welcoming Sarah Ooten to LSE to deliver her lecture entitled Dare to Do, Taking on the Planet by Bike and Boat. Thank you.
Thank you, Tina, for the introduction, and thank you, folks, for coming out on a Thursday night for a bit of adventure chat. I feel like I should have somehow sort of abseiled in from the ceiling, Bear Grylls style, or something like that, with the title, you know, Taking on the Planet by Bike and Boat. But anyone who knows me, and certainly who followed my journey, knows that it was more the planet that sort of took on me, it felt like, or it certainly had the upper hand most of the time. So I'd like to share with you tonight some of the stories from my journey and tell you what happened. Interestingly, I can't see the upcoming slides on my screen in front of me, so forgive any hesitation, pauses, repetition, that kind of thing. So, what's next really does embody that question, what's next? Well, anyway, do any of you remember that moment at school, or multiple moments perhaps, when people said to you, so, what are you going to do when you leave school, Sarah? And then maybe onwards at university, what are you going to do when you graduate, when you leave university? And I don't know about you, but sometimes I found that there were moments of kind of going, ah, I don't know what the heck I'm going to do next. And I think the older and wiser that you get, I mean, that seems ironic that I'm saying that aged 31 now. But it really feels like that, doesn't it? Sort of the older you get, perhaps, you kind of realise, well, it doesn't always matter if you don't know exactly what's happening next. So I remember when I was at university in my final year, getting ready to graduate, or at least I hoped I was about to graduate. My principal said to me, "So, Sarah, what are you doing when you leave here?" I said, "Well, principal, I'm going to row across the Indian Ocean in 2009. And he sat there and said, "But what are you going to do?" As though somehow rowing across the Indian Ocean wasn't sort of good enough, really, for him. Perhaps he wanted me to get a proper job, quote unquote. By the way, what is that, really, a proper job? Now, you see, I had this eureka moment, whoever it was that was naked in the bath one day and shouted that, although I wasn't naked in the bath when it happened to me, had this moment of sort of eureka in my second year at university, so a year before, when I first heard about ocean rowing. Because I grew up in Rutland, which, let's have a show of hands, who actually knows where Rutland is or what it is? By about four of you, great. Doesn't surprise me. So it's a tiny county, kind of in the middle of England, in between Nottinghamshire, Leicestershire and Lincolnshire, miles from the sea. And so aged 20, when I had an email pop into my inbox whilst I'm supposed to be writing an essay on something, when the title of that email said, "Ocean Rowing Races," I just thought, boom, that is exciting, and that is what I'm going to do when I leave here. In my head, that was enough. I was going to have a big adventure. The idea you could row a little boat across an ocean seemed brilliant. I love the oceans, I love boats, I love rowing. I thought I'd go with a team of people, and I asked all my friends and family, "Who wants to come rowing?" Yeah. That's what they said too. And nobody wanted to come with me, apparently. My best friend, Roosty, just ignored all the emails and thought that maybe that would sort of stop it a little bit. But it didn't. I went to that university that's really good at rowing, Oxford. That's it, not that. What's that called? Cambridge or something up the road? Anyway, so I knew that I'd get people who wanted to do it. I knew somehow we'd find it and we'd make this plan and we'd go rowing. I knew that I wanted it to be the Indian Ocean, which felt a bit like a forgotten ocean. The Atlantic is a bit of a runway at times, a bit of a motorway. The Pacific, it's so huge, why would you do that? And so that was the plan. I started to get some inquiries about joining my team. And then, all of a sudden, my dad died very unexpectedly. And that kind of changed everything for me. And I knew in an instant, really, pretty quickly, that I still wanted to row across the Indian Ocean. And now I wanted to go solo. I wanted to make that journey in my dad's memory and use it as a positive vehicle for me and to raise money for charities. And so that is what I did after university. It was sort of 3 years between saying I want to do it to actually finding myself out in Australia with my little white boat, Dippers, on the shore, looking out to sea, hopefully trained enough, hopefully just about enough money in the bank. And that was a beg, steal, borrow business, really, of make it work somehow. And off I went, out onto my big adventure. Those first few strokes, feeling quite terrified about the whole thing. For 3 years, I'd been all excited, "I'm going to row across the ocean." And it comes to it, and you just think, whoa, that ocean's a lot bigger in real life. And actually, my first run out there didn't go exactly to plan. 10 days after starting, due to some funky weather and some currents, I ended up back in Australia at the start. And lots of people said to me, "Oh, commiserations, mate. You're just going to go back home?" I said, "No. That is my warm-up lap." And I pretty much just sort of washed my hair and packed the boat again and went out to sea a week later. And I think it's fair to say that those 4 months out at sea were life-changing. On a couple of occasions, they were probably life-ending. No, they weren't life-ending, nearly life-ending. It was pretty extreme circumstances. It was intense, it was immersive, it was beautiful, it was mad, it was crazy, and it felt like it sort of blew my mind and opened my mind to the idea that there's different ways of living. I know if this sounds really obvious, but this was my big moment of realisation, age 24, was there's different ways of doing things. You don't have to do what everyone else maybe thinks or you think that they think you have to do. And it opened my eyes to the idea of spending big times out on the ocean, out in the wild. Ever since I was this big, little, I've spent a lot of time outside. When people say, how did you get to do what you're doing today, Sarah? I think that my family time when I was younger had a lot to do with it. I was basically running away from my dad's really short shorts. No joking. Honestly, he did wear proper clothes sometimes. But we spent a lot of time. I'm sorry I've just drawn attention to that. Just focus in. Eyes on the speaker. We spent a lot of time out and about, just doing simple stuff like going for dog walks, swimming in rivers, having holidays in caravans underneath mountains, which it's nothing especially fancy, but I think the older I get, I realise not everybody gets to do that stuff. And certainly for me, the freedom that I was allowed just to run, not riot, but, run about and explore and sort of test my own boundaries in an unstructured way and realise that I loved that kind of power of moving yourself from one place to another, that was really powerful. When I was 12, my brother started going to the kayaking club down the road, Rutland Water, and so I thought, I want to do that too. And so once a week, I went out and kayaked and learned a little bit more and went a little bit further, such that for the week in my half term, in my A-level year, when I probably should have been doing a bit of revision, I was actually up in Scotland on a small kayaking trip with the canoe club. And that was the first time, I suppose, I'd done a sort of an extended few days away. And I just thought, whoa, this is great. I always want my life to have journeys in it. I love that combination of sort of the physicality of things with the mental challenges of making a safe passage between places. I love the way that wildlife is unafraid of you, it's curious. I love the way when you're on land, people aren't really afraid of you if you're just on a bike and you smell a bit. So that's really where it's all come from. And when I made that journey across the Indian Ocean in 2009, I obviously spent a lot of time thinking about what's next. And it seems that lots of other people thought that I ought to have been thinking about what's next as well, because I remember as soon as I stepped off the boat onto the beach in Mauritius, people said, "So, Sarah, what's next?" And whilst I was out at sea, I'd been thinking, kind of dreaming, about the idea of another journey. I wanted more time on the ocean, and I wanted to travel across land and meet some people. Because on the Indian Ocean, the only person that I sort of met, quote unquote, was the captain of a container ship who I called up on the radio one morning when I realised that it was kind of coming straight for me like that. And I called him up, and it's quite close, a couple of miles away, less than a couple of miles away, that makes it sound really like, woo, quite close. Called him up on the radio, and I said, do you see me? And he said, it's good to talk to you. Do you need assistance? Or are you just one of those mad adventurers? And I just thought, phew, just a mad adventurer, don't worry. But I thought I'd like to meet people. And so in my head, perhaps slightly naively, because I was only 24, I thought, I've done the Indian Ocean. That was hard, but it wasn't rocket science. Well, let's just apply that sort of simple theory to the rest of the planet. And this is sort of what I came up with, roughly. Yeah, like I said, I was naive. So the idea was to make a human-powered journey, starting and finishing in London, travelling eastwards, because I wanted it to include the North Pacific. I knew the North Pacific would be big and challenging and stacked with interesting wildlife. And the way geography works is that you have to cross oceans in certain directions if you're silly enough not to take engines, proper engines. So it had to be eastwards. The timings had to be based on the seasons for those crossings. And obviously a bike's not going to work too well on land, so I'd cycle the land sections. I'd row the ocean sections because a rowing boat means you can live at sea for months at a time a little bit more comfortably than you could in a kayak, which in my mind, that's just sort of kamikaze. So a kayak would be used for the sort of coastal sections. That's really all there is to say about that. I thought it would take 2.5 years. I knew that I'd need a team of people to help make it happen. No woman is an island and all that. But I knew that that team wouldn't just be a core team of people helping sort of activate and support and manage different things from afar, but it would also include a wider team of sponsors and people who'd help pay for it too, because it was going to be quite an expensive journey. Now, over and above wanting to have a huge adventure and to learn and to experience and to feel all the things that you get from travelling and being away, I also wanted to share the journey. I also thought when I was younger I'd be a teacher, and now I've realised I'm not really ever so good at staying put in a classroom for too long. So I wanted to make this journey almost a kind of school of sorts in bringing kids into the expedition and bringing the expedition into the classroom. And then separate to that was my goal to raise money for these four charities across the bottom. Copperfield, Breast Cancer Awareness Charity. Check your boobs or somebody else's if you do nothing else tonight. Not necessarily whilst you're here. I mean, like, once you go home and you're in your bathroom, whatever. But watch it. Jubilee Sailing Trust, it's all about accessible sailing for everybody. Motor Neurone Disease Association and WaterAid, all about fresh water and sanitation for communities around the world that don't have it. So that's the essence of why, where, roughly how. The journey actually took 4.5 years, not 2.5 years, and quite a bit more money than we imagined, and didn't turn out exactly as we planned, and I think it was all the better for those things. These pictures here show that it was a journey of contrasts. In the way that I travelled, the places I travelled, the people I met, the things that happened. And I think that's one of the reasons why I love travelling so much, is different perspectives, different ways of doing things. I'm part of a farming family nowadays, very happy to say, and this is for the farmers. So on the left-hand side is a picture of the massive grain silos out in the American Midwest versus the sort of threshing of the corn by hand in the Yellow Valley in China versus the pretty neat rows of drilled crops up in an autumnal Hokkaido in Japan. I just love that idea that there's so many different ways of doing things, so many contrasts kind of between and within countries and within cultures. And I suppose that sort of curiosity from my part outwards was reciprocated as well. People wondering what the heck I was doing on their patch, dressed in lycra or looking really scruffy. I often had kind of mothers in Kazakhstan grabbing the collar on my shirt and kind of going, needs a wash, something like that. I mean, it was true, I did need a lot of washes, but that's a way of summing up the journey, as those contrasts. I'm a bit of a nature geek. I love my wild things, and I always thought that it would be the wild places, the wild things that not would mean the most to me, but that perhaps would be, I don't know if it's the most memorable, but certainly humility within nature was a big theme of my journey. The scale of things, the very tiny to the massive, the overwhelming in the terms of big storms, to the fragility of things. I mean, look at that tiny little bird that I'm releasing out to sea. This is quite weird, by the way, isn't it? There's so many screens everywhere I look. So all those little birds, so they're storm petrels, and they seem to congregate around the light on my boat way out to sea at night, and they'll sort of flap around, and they love the light so much they sort of flop into the boat, and they can't get out. So then they scratch around in the boat, keeping me awake, so I would lift them up and sort of pop them out to sea like so. And I remember one of the first times that that happened, I'm taking a picture with my GoPro there. I'm sort of releasing this little bird, thinking I'm doing it a massive favour, and going, go on, little bird, be safe out there. And then you think, whoa, that little bird is way better adapted to life at sea. than I am. And so I think humility is definitely a word that came out through the journey for me. And I think, I think in the other direction was the sort of number of times you see that, okay, nature is all kind of powerful and humanity is nothing in the face of nature, but the reverse is that you see the sort of massive negative impacts of humanity on the planet and the wild places and wild things. This here's a Russian bear, an ex-circus bear, sent over to the Russian island of Sakhalin from the mainland after its circus days are over, and it's being kept in a tiny, fetid, rusty cell. And I think a similar thing would be the massive open-cast coal mines that I saw in China, often passing 40-mile-long truck jams as coal is chucked across the country. And that's not to say that China or Russia are any worse with sort of their negative planetary impacts than Great Britain is. They're just two examples. But I think those words, sort of contrast and humility, were really important. But by the same token, for all those contrasts and differences, it was the people who stand out for me, I suppose, perhaps the most memorable. And I think for all that sort of contrasting differences, borders, etc., it's actually just a massive feeling of connection between everybody. You notice when you meet people, and I'm sure lots of people have sort of maybe drawn similar conclusions because I've heard it from other sort of traveling folk too, is that you're meeting people from all walks of life and sort of different spheres and different stories, but of course they're all connected because they're all human stories. That sort of humanity and the human experience. I loved how open people were. It felt really special and really humbling to have people share their stories with me, to share their hopes, their fears. I mean, up in that sort of top picture up there, this one just here, we're helping the lady in the middle of the picture, Matsumura-san, build a flower garden where her house once stood. She was unfortunate enough to be living in the zone just off the coast in Ishinomaki, where the tsunami of 2011 came in and ravaged kilometres and kilometres of homes. And then in the bottom, this picture here, the bottom here, is Della. My friend Justine, my kayaking partner Justine, and I had arrived on her island into her community. She was welcoming us in. And over the next couple of days, finding out about her life out there, I said, so what's the deal with bears around here? Do sort of bears and people get on quite well? Any problems? And she said, my nephew was killed by a bear however many years ago. And I think that kind of openness of people is really powerful. It was humbling. And to be taken in by people, by strangers, just spontaneously and sort of generously welcomed into their lives for a moment, perhaps, for some chai in Kazakhstan, for some pie in America. This is Susie, who found me at the bottom of a creek. I mean, not like at the bottom of the creek, but, you know, I'm riding my bike down, and I was really scared because I'm scared of heights. So there's this big drop-off on one side, and it's really tall on the other side. So halfway down the creek, I'm sort of standing there, and she arrived and waved, wound down the window and said, are you all right? I said, not really. Glad that I'm on the uphill now. And she said, can I give you a hug? And I said, sure, you can give me a hug. And normally I'm a bit weird about randomers giving me hugs, right? So she found me the next day on the road. I had moved on from the creek, but she said, she stopped her bus again and she said, can I take you home for some pie? Heck yes. And of course, in Russia, it was all about the vodka. This was Nadia. She's just been crying as she sees me off after, after we spent the night together. It wasn't like that. After I spent the night in her home, and she's waved us off in the morning at 10 o'clock in the morning with a tray of vodka and blinis. And she was worried that I might die, but I'd like to tell her that I didn't. But anyway, that hospitality, that warmth, that kindness. I mean, for all that Brexit embarrassment and tragedy of the summer, I just wish that all of us could feel more connection with our fellow humans rather than not. Because, that was a picture I found in Japan. Anyway, this is the story that I want you to remember. It's my favorite story. Siona, glad you could join us. It's my favorite story from the expedition, second only to getting engaged. And this young man in the picture that I'm speaking to is called Gao. He's a young Chinese guy, and we met about half an hour before this picture was taken. We met in a petrol station, and my bike, Hercules, was sat outside with all his gear on, and I'm inside choosing my breakfast. And I noticed Gao was looking at my bike, and then Gao was by my side. Ni hao, hello. I said, hi, yeah. Is that your bike outside? Yes, that's Hercules the adventure bike. Wow, cool. He said, where have you come from? I said, London. Wow, cool. Where are you going? London. Wow, cool. I said, I'm so proud of you. And he went on to say that he really wanted to do a bike journey. He said he'd always wanted to, but it looked so difficult. It looks really expensive, it looks really hard work. And I said, buddy, it's just like riding a bike. Because I think it kind of is. You can plan all you like in the world, but mostly I think you can just jump on a bike and go. So I said that to him, and he said, okay, great, thanks. Good luck, good luck. I went one way, Gao went the other. And half an hour down the road, I'm cycling along, eating my breakfast, rather, and honk, 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 a car pulls up. Gao runs across the road, arms flailing, carrying a road atlas in his hand. Sarah, you need a companion. I want to come with you to Beijing on a bicycle. Right, geography of China. First of all, it's massive. We're sort of over here in Xinjiang province. Beijing is probably about hand width in from the coast. It's quite far. And the Gobi Desert lies between us. And he's a stranger. So I was thinking, oh, wasn't expecting that. Just tell me a bit more about your plans, Gao. Kind of wondering how I could put him down politely, being British and all that. And meanwhile, Gao was telling me all the ways in which it would be great if we travelled together. Sarah, you be the leader. I'll be the guide. I said, Gao, the Gobi Desert, ooh, it's going to be really hot. He said, don't worry, we'll get food and waters. We'll travel at night when it's colder. I was like, God, he's thought about this, hasn't he? And because there was that slight feeling of, what if I have to tell his mother that he's just died with a random chick he met in front of the wasabi peas? Just thought, it's not going to look too good. And he's showing me all the places on the roadmap where we'll stop and all of this. And, oh, I know someone here, da-da-da-da-da. And there was, again, a little bit of a eureka moment when I thought, of course he can come. You've just told him it's really easy and you can just go. You should just have a go and see what happens. Because what is the worst that could happen? I thought, well, if it doesn't work out, he can just go home in 2 days. And hopefully he will have had some fun. So I said, okay, sure, great. That'll be lovely to have company. Let's meet in 2 days' time. At which point, Gao says, okay, I'll go and buy a bicycle. I mean, that is cool, isn't it? I already thought kudos to you, pal, because you've just asked a stranger if you can join their journey, and you don't even have the wheels yet. I said, have you done much cycling before? Oh no, just, you know, a few miles. So I wrote him a list of things he ought to bring with him, including a tent. You know, underline, bring your own tent. And I sent him off with a shopping list, not quite knowing what was going to happen next. And so, 2 days later, this young man here with his floppy hair and his sort of pulled up t-shirt sleeves, the way he's showing me his muscles, turned up looking like this. Pretty sweet, isn't it? Because obviously you can't have an adventure if you've got hair. And he's got a huge flag on the back of his bike, a Chinese flag. That's because, according to him, his brother had said to him, "Gao, you must have a Chinese flag, but it must be bigger than Sarah's." He won. Enough said. I also said to him, "Your bike's got to have a name, because all my bikes and things have names." And at the end of this first day cycling together, he said, "Okay, Sarah, I call my bike Stranger." I thought, well, he's a poet too. And then there was also that slightly sadistic thing of, but your bum's going to be no stranger to that saddle very soon. And I said to him, "You know, are you excited?" And he said, "I'm always excited." And I thought, yeah, I get that. And I said, "Are you nervous?" And he said he'd been so nervous that he couldn't sleep that night. So I said, "Okay, we've just got to go." Because that's what you've got to do with butterflies, isn't it? You've just got to go. And then they settle in. So we cycled off out through town, bikes laden and going for it. And as I was approaching this sort of junction here, I could see that triangle in the road and I could see a line of things along the floor. And Gao said to me, "Sarah, faster!" as he arrived at my side. And there's someone doing this. And so I'm going like this. And as we approach that line of stuff down the road in the orange triangle, it all starts exploding. Pew, 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 pew. And I realise that Gao's family, who've come to wave him off, have set off a line of firecrackers down the motorway. China was kind of crazy right from the start for me, and I sort of got this impression that that's really what it was going to be like, and it sort of was. They don't lie about the desert. That's definitely hot and dusty. Cycling through the Turfan region, it was sort of 50 degrees centigrade, Celsius, whatever you call it, at the middle of the day, so quite hot work, thirsty work. I remember sometimes cycling along and I'd see discarded watermelon skins at the side of the road. And I'd be cycling along, sort of having run out of water, just thinking, I wonder what that would be like to taste that. And you just think, no, just a bit further. And I'm happy to say I didn't ever have to nibble the discarded watermelon skins, but I thought about it. It was tough and quite tiring work across the desert. I mean, Gao, bless him, he fell asleep at every opportunity, at every meal. We'd stop and eat, and I'd eat a few plates of food, and he'd be asleep after a short while. But it was amazing to see how he grew in sort of confidence and skill from obviously the first day onwards. We were cycling for 35 days together. It was a really special time to be sharing the experience with somebody, to be getting his perspectives on the experience, on the country. I could tell him stuff about my country. I remember one day we cycled with an American hairdresser, of all things. He was on a world tour. And afterwards, Gao said, "You know, Sarah, it's really strange, because I thought that all Americans were noisy and rude. And Andy, well, he's really quiet and polite. And Sarah, I thought that all British people were quiet and polite." And yeah. So I loved that way that we sort of changed each other's perspectives on things. And certainly for me, having Gao there as translator was really special. I remember this story particularly. We stopped at the tea house. This man on the left is the owner of the tea house. Really hot. And so we stop and we have tea. And he brings out a load of little cards of other travellers that have done exactly the same as we have. And it says, "Megan Lewis riding a horse from Shanghai to Wales. So-and-so from Amsterdam pushing a buggy across the country," whatever sort of thing. And we left our own. And he brought out one card, which he said was really special to him. It said, "Joseph Carme, cycling around the world for 25 years. Yeah, pretty cool. Aged 83. And this gentleman talked about Joseph as being really special to him, because he'd stayed at his tea house for, I don't know, 6 weeks or something. He'd been poorly when he was there, so this guy said, "Oh, you know, I look at him as my son. It was a really special time. I hope he comes back one day." And I kind of went, well, we've got mobile phones. And I pulled up a picture of Joseph. He's bronze, he's got massive sideburns, he's got his bike, no flag, funnily. But anyway, told this gentleman here, and then I realised that what I was reading was his obituary. And he'd actually died just 3 weeks on down the road from this tea house, which was really sad, but kind of beautiful as well to know that, well, his story is still inspiring people when they come in gasping from the heat. It took us 35 days to reach Beijing together, and when we got there, I filmed a little piece with Gao, and so I'm going to play that now. This is a moment I thought would never happen. We've just landed in...
I can't use this word, happiness.
It does make you kind of want to cry a bit, doesn't it? But also sort of yee-ha at him. And I think that's why I love Gao so much, is because of the power of his story, in that we all get scared of stuff. We all get demons in our head and those big sort of scary what-ifs when we want to do stuff, and it sort of holds us back. And I think Gao's example of saying, okay, let's have a go, is really powerful. So it said at the end of that film that I was in touch with Gao and sort of, you know, hoped that we'd be able to cycle together. That film's a little bit out of date. I sort of lost contact with him at the end of 2013, and I kept emailing and phoning, but there was just never a response. And so I just hoped that he'd be, you know, happy and well and all that. I've just written a book, you know. And whilst I was writing it, towards the end there, I really wanted to make sure that I could get Gao into the story, sort of give an update. And so in the summer, I started trying to call him again. And a couple of months ago, he answered the phone. Now, first of all, he said, oh, no way, Potter, it's you. Because he always used to call me Potter, because he said that I could magic anything that he needed out of my panniers. And then he apologised for being so rubbish at keeping in contact. He kept saying, my bad. I'm sorry I haven't been in touch. And he said, well, Sarah, I've got a surprise for you. I'm married now. I said, wow, that's great, Gao. Congratulations. And I said, Gao, I've got a surprise for you. I'm married now. And he said, wow, what does your husband do? And I said, she's a farmer. And he just went silent. It was a little bit awkward for a couple of minutes as I reeled off how we'd met, just all the story. And then he said, Sarah, do you love her? I said, yes, I do. I said, you can marry who you like in England nowadays. And no, that's nothing against you, Liz. I think it was that whole woman thing. And he said, well, that's perfect. Now we have something in common. And I said, well, Gao, we've got to meet. We've got to let our girls meet. And I said, maybe you can come here or we can come there at some point. And he said, well, I'm quite free next month. And I thought, of course you're not going to come. And then I thought, it's Gao, of course he is going to come. And sure enough, 4 days later, I had an email from him saying, this is my itinerary. We're coming on a tour. And sadly, just about a couple of days, a few days before they were due to come, he sent an email saying our visas have been turned down. Not like cards at the airports or banking things, but, you know, that old boring visa stuff. So we haven't seen each other this year, but I'm determined that we shall meet up again soon. I said to him also, well, have you done any cycling recently? Oh, yes, sir, I've got a new bike. What have you got? Oh, you know me, Sarah? It's a mountain bike. Good. And what's it called, Gao? He said, of course, it's Stranger 2. So Gao very much still lives on. I know that I've been chatting on for quite a long time, but I'm going to just skip through this next story for you as well. It's the story of the Pacific Ocean, which I always knew would be the party piece of the journey. And it sort of did turn out to be the party piece of the journey. This is me sitting with my rowing boat, Gulliver, in the spring of 2012. So I've done Europe and Asia kayaking and cycling in that first year. And then here I am with Gulliver 7-metre-long rowing boat and all the gear I need to go out to sea and survive for hopefully about 6 months, because that's what we think it'll take me to get from Japan over to Canada. So literally everything I might possibly need on there. I've got solar panels to charge batteries, I've got a drinks cabinet, I've got medical kits, spares, repairs, birthday presents, clothes for every eventuality and probably a bit extra, and off I go. The middle of May 2012, feeling a riot of emotions. Probably a bit like Gao, excited and nervous, definitely seasick, heading out to sea. Now, I normally like to take about a month to settle in, although it didn't really turn out that way on this journey. That routine of rowing and sleeping and eating and taking care of the boat was kind of just getting into the swing of things when I had an email from my weather router saying that he didn't want to spoil the party, but he kind of was going to anyway, in that Typhoon Mawar had just formed down in the Philippines. It had already killed 3 people. It was riding north up that coast of the Pacific and was due to recurve, and unfortunately, I was kind of within 100 miles of the centre, which isn't a very good place to be. And he said, you've got a couple of decisions, Sarah. You can stay, literally batten down the hatches, or you can get a preemptive evacuation bypassing shipping. And obviously, being quite a big decision, I did take some time to think about it, although there's not a lot of time to think about those things. And according to all the data and so on, and speaking to different people, I made the decision to stay. And so I went about battening down the hatches and preparing my cabin, because I knew that I'd only be able to lie strapped to the bunk in my cabin for the 3 days, which were forecast to be super big conditions. I prepared mentally as well. And I thought that writing smile on one hand and breathe on the other would be quite good reminders of nice things to do during the storm, which I knew wouldn't feel ever so nice. It turns out it's impossible to smile when you're terrified, just in case you'd wondered about that. They were 3 of the most frightening days of my life, and probably it's fair to say 3 of the most frightening for those around me as well back home. The winds were blowing as fast as you drive down the motorway, and the waves were topping out at 15 plus metres. And it was like a crazy sort of fairground ride that once you've been on it once, you'd never want to go through it again, and you certainly wouldn't be telling your mates to go and have a go, unless you really didn't like them. And you know, when as a child, or maybe now, you're swung around by your arms like this, and you feel the G-force like that. It kind of felt like that a lot of the time, except with more sort of capsizing and more fear, I suppose. Halfway through the storm system, I clocked that Gulliver, my boat, had sustained too much damage for me to be able to carry on safely. And so I called for assistance, a rescue, which involved the Japan Coast Guard coming out in one of their big boats, 700 miles out to sea. It was very kind of them to come and make me safe. And they picked me up and took me off my little boat, who I waved off into the sunset with tears in my eyes, and I came home. Now, unfortunately, one of the lovely Coast Guard people, had taken the tracker off my boat, the satellite tracker, which we had hoped we'd be able to use to salvage my boat. So that meant we didn't know where Gulliver was. So I came home sort of boatless and pretty broken, really. It took a couple of weeks for it to sink in, I think, what had happened. That trauma of being trapped in a little boat by myself for 3 days then proceeded to just explode out and turn me into a very broken wreck, I suppose. And it was quite a few months of piecing myself back together with the help of lots of people around me. I think that's a really good learning to have come out of it as well. I think if we break a leg, we're all, you know, it's all okay to kind of go, whoa, do you want to sign my plaster? And when things go wrong up here and in here, I think we're a bit more closed about it, a bit more worried about what other people are going to think. But one of the things I remember during that really dark time was other people saying to me, hey, it's okay. I've been in a broken place before. And I remember one of my sponsors, who I thought was, you know, one of the people that would say, no, we don't ever want to sponsor you again, you're rubbish. She said to me, Sarah, I've been there before. The demons have latched on and they're hard to shake. But don't worry, you'll do it in your own time. And she said, look, I believe in you, even if you don't believe in yourself at the moment. And that was really key to like turning a corner and saying with confidence, well, I'm going back out there. We'll make that happen. I knew that I wanted to go back out to the ocean. It was just a question of how, because I didn't have a boat and boats are expensive. But happily, my insurers had insured me to start with, which was surprising and brilliant. And they paid out enough on the boat to be able to buy a new boat. Well, she was a second-hand boat, the sister boat to Gulliver, my first one. She was called Sox, which I thought was quite a rubbish name, more for guinea pigs and horses and things. So I decided we'd call her Happy Socks, because my mum knits these socks that we call Happy Socks, and they make me really happy. So back out to Japan 9 months after that rescue, and you can see I'm quite delighted, really. I think this picture sums up that line between fear and fun, which for me is sort of what adventure's all about, really. It's beautiful and it's exciting and it's challenging, and sometimes you don't know if you're going to be okay. Again, there was that settling into things, and it seemed to be that there was a lot of time on this second journey spent lying in my cabin, not looking too happy because the weather was really rough, and using the sea anchor, this big yellow and red parachute, which kind of acts as a bit of a drag queen behind your boat, slowing things down so that you don't lose miles in the stormy stuff and so that you don't capsize so often in the stormy stuff. Now, there's lots of going where you don't want to go on an ocean row, because there's currents that squiggle and squirl your way around. And this picture on the left is a depiction of some of those currents. And this picture on the right is a little snapshot of my track for a 100-mile section of the journey between months 3 and 4. So you can see that really I don't go anywhere especially useful. And setting out to sea, you know that's going to happen when your guns are only this big. You know, you accept it and mentally you're sort of prepared for it. And it's a good job there's no landmarks on the ocean. So day by day, when you end up somewhere backwards of your previous position, at least there's not something reminding you that you are. And people say, how do you deal with that? I think acceptance is a part of it. But also for me, a part of it was getting to know this fella. So there's a really cool book called The Chimp Paradox by Professor Steve Peters, or as my friend Reese says, the Monkey in the Brain book. And it basically is. It's a model of the mind which names these three parts of the brain. You've got the chimp, which is your animal brain. You've got the human, which is your logical, rational brain, which makes decisions based on truth and facts and so on. By the way, your monkey's the opposite of that. It's all about desire and instinct, fight or flight. And then you've got your computer, which is the sort of processing center. And Steve Peters says that the balance between those and knowing how your chimp works and what your chimp needs means that you'll get the best out of yourself and be able to manage yourself in the best way. And so for me out on the Pacific in those really stormy times when I was going backwards, I basically talked to this small finger puppet chimp and told Chimpy, hey, it's okay, Chimpy, I know you're scared today, but I'm scared too. We're going to get through this, okay? And that's kind of how I managed it for the most part. But then Chimpy got a bit wound up that we weren't really going where I told him we were going to go. 4 months in, I wasn't even halfway across the ocean. Winter would be coming, the storms would be getting bigger. It's no place for a boat in the winter, especially a little rowing boat. And so my team and I looked at the map of the Pacific and decided on a new plan. Clearly, I wasn't going to make it to Canada by myself. And so the Pacific. There's not too many options of places to go. But there was one. So where that big yellow dot is at the top there, there's an island in amongst the Aleutian Islands, which run westwards from mainland Alaska, an island called Adak. It's an ex-naval base, so it's got infrastructure. It has a small population of about 100 people. That looked like the place that I could land. So I turned left, and I rode like Billy O to the north for a month, and by the time I got there, on day 150, I was tired and getting poorly, and the boat was tired, had lost a rudder recently, the batteries were pretty much dead, and it was really a good time to see land. And it was a beautiful thing to come ashore on this little green island that had massive kind of volcanic peaks, all striking and beautiful, even if I couldn't see them because it was misty. But the community there kind of understood, I think, what it is to be out and a bit remote for months at a time. And it was a really gentle welcome. Welcome to Adak, Sarah. You rock and row. So I came home so that we could train and plan for the next stage of the journey, which was to be all the way along the Aleutian Islands and up the Alaskan Peninsula to where the first road starts, up on the mainland. Someone on my team had said, Sarah, it's America. There'll be a road at the end of the peninsula. And I said, Tony, this is Alaska. That's totally different. Someone had said to me on coming home, they said, are you disappointed that you didn't make it to Canada? I said, I'm going to Alaska. Doesn't it just make you excited to say that word? Go on, say it. Alaska. It's exciting, isn't it? And it certainly turned out to be exciting. The trip that we made, I say we, Justine Kagenvan. Justine kayaked all the different kayaking legs with me because she's the queen of sea kayaking. And when I started, I really wasn't. I'm still not, but I mean, I really wasn't. This isn't Justine here, by the way, in the picture. So Justine and I kayaked together for 101 days along the islands up the chain. On this beautiful journey. It was really poignant almost to be up there in the Aleutians because it's one of the areas where the precursor to the modern kayak was invented, the ikyak. I mean, back in the day, native communities up in that region would wear kind of fish skin, cam-like sort of cagoule type things and hats with walrus whiskers sticking out the top, and that's how they traveled about. And today it's almost disappeared from the islands. It's all kind of motorized skiffs and so on. But it was really special to travel together. It's a really remote and treacherous place. You've got the Bering Sea on one side, which is really cold, the Pacific Sea to the south, where warm air kind of comes up. The meeting of those two air systems means you get big storms happening, running eastwards up to the mainland. So Justine's a filmmaker as well. She made a beautiful film of that journey. I'm going to show you a 2-minute trailer for it, and hopefully it'll encourage you to go and buy her film. Should be this one here. Oh, where are we? It is here. Moby? Can you see the film icon on your computer at the back there? And it's got some really cute pictures of otters and things. Okay, I don't seem to be able to... I can't click on it on here. So that's not going to work. But imagine breathtaking scenery of volcanoes that look like this, otters that just look cute, sea lions that look kind of stinky and roary, big waves and jeopardy and all of that. That's what you get in the film and sums up the journey together. There are a few scattered communities along the islands. 17 people on this tiny island in Nikolsky purported to have had residents, people, sort of community based in that area for 9,000 years. Just super nuts. And it was beautiful for that interaction with people out on the islands. And there was this wonderful sense of endurance about the place in some ways. So the community that's been there for 9,000 years. Over on this side here, it's a picture of a piece of petrified wood in this section of petrified forest. So a few thousand years ago, a glacier swept down the mountainside, knocking out a whole sort of forest and covering it in mud. And it's now this sort of lumpy, weird sort of forest on the beach versus this interesting challenge of maintaining their cultural identity within the face of a homogenizing, globalizing world. It was a really beautiful journey for that. And that's Justine's smiling face right there. And a bird's eye view of me when I go to the toilet out in my kayak, and we're sort of rafting up alongside each other. Some of those crossings were really long. So you can't get out of the boat for sort of 18 hours or something. And that's how you have to go to the toilet, sort of straddling the two boats, holding on to the other person's head perhaps, aiming for the middle of the boats or their boat if you can't make the middle. And yeah, you raise your eyebrows, sir. It was like that. And one day I remember we're crossing a sort of a 10-mile sort of bay, essentially, and we just had lunch and we're paddling along, and I said, "Oh, Justine, when we get to the other side, I'm going to need to nip to the loo." And I said, "Okay, we're paddling along." "Justine, I'm going to go a bit faster." "Oh, Justine, I'm going to go really fast." And she said, "You can just raft up on my boat if you like." So I said, "No, I don't think that's going to be good for either of us." And a moment later, "Justine, come here." And as I'm standing up on the boats and holding onto her head and undoing my zip, ready to go, I said, "Just sing as loud as you can and hold your nose." And the only song that Justine could remember was, "I'm a Little Teapot." So anyone with young kids, just remember that as you're singing along next time. Anyway, that's enough toilet chat. We arrived in Homer on the mainland, the end of the road or the start of it, whichever way you look at it. People were already telling me about winter. It was the very last day in August when I set off. Apparently when the fireweed seeds, it's 6 weeks till snow. And so I'm pedaling as fast as I can up and over the mountains of beautiful autumnal Alaska, turning right down through BC, down into Canada. It got really slushy with the snow in the mountains, and then all of a sudden I was in the prairies and the temperature had dropped to sort of minus 20, minus 30, and it was super cold and super snowy. And then Lucy arrived, my fiancé. So it was just before that time, up in autumnal Alaska, when I was thinking, I don't think I can do it. I don't think I can be apart for another year. I want to go home. I'm in love. I mean, how many stories do you read of people going away and just harping on about how much they love the person at home? And I always read those stories going like, "Oh my God, how boring. Tell us about the scenery." Here I am. It happened. And Lucy said to me, "You're not coming home until you've paddled under Tower Bridge." And so we made a plan that she would come out and join me on the bike for 2 months. And that, in my head, gave me enough of a focus to think, okay, I can do this. And so Lucy joined me in Calgary. I really apologize that it was so cold when you arrived. So I thought it'd be really good for Lucy to sort of train as soon as she got there. And I said, okay, we're going to cycle out today and we're going to stay in the tent tonight. Even though it's the first time she's ever really cycle toured. That night there was a blizzard. And we're lying in our sort of all our gear in the tent like this. And Lucy just turned to me and said, "What are we doing?" And it sort of felt like that for the next couple of months, really. Not quite knowing if it was going to be okay, if we'd get to the other side on time. I needed to be on the East Coast by the spring. Lots of people were very surprised to see us out cycling. In one place, somebody said, "You do know there's nothing down that road." And we said, "Yeah, we just need something to aim for." And then just a little way down the road, they said, "You know that nobody cycles out here, not even in the summer. We're just, you know, jogging along." That's fine. So many people had stopped when I was further north to ask if I needed a lift, as though, you know, I'd had to resort to the bike to travel because my car must have broken down or something. So I wrote on the back, "Don't worry, I'm okay." And Lucy had on the back of hers, "I'm with crazy." And that's really how we made our way across the country, looking like Mrs. and Mrs. Christmas every night. Of course, it's winter, it's dark for most of the day. People often pulled over just to check that we weren't a police car or something with, you know, all our red lights and white lights all over the bike. And it was on our last day, we're just coming in towards Minneapolis, that we had our coldest night in the tent. It was about minus 45, which is really cold. So I get asthma, and in the cold it gets bad. So I was lying in my tent, in the sleeping bag, and kind of sit up, just trying to breathe through the ice in the air, and lying in the sleeping bag, and I moved a bit, and my sleeping bag zip broke. So I said, "Lucy, it's like the movies. We've got to get into the same sleeping bag to survive." I mean, that was the romance on our trip. And so I'm sort of wiggling out, and I wiggle into Lucy's sleeping bag. We're lying there looking a little bit weird and feeling a bit squashed, and it wasn't going to work. And so I said, "Okay, I'm going to just have a loo trip," which is basically a saucepan at the end of the tent. At which point Lucy says, "Oh yeah, and I've got something in my toe which I need to get it out, it's itching." And so she sort of gets out of her bag, and I'm having a wee, and she goes, "Oh no, there's nothing in my toe, it's just I can't feel my toe." She's giggling a bit, and I sort of turn round, like, "This is really serious, Lucy." And her toe is just white across the end, like it might fall off or something. And Lucy's kind of going, "How did that happen?" And I'm going, "Oh my God." And so, again, just to sort of increase the romance, I put her toe underneath my armpit. I sat there for sort of half an hour with it, rubbing her leg, massaging it, and she's kind of going, "Oh, how funny, it's just a toe," and things. And that really sort of summed up our trip together. I'm happy to report Lucy still has all 10 toes. It did pop back to life again. And here, apparently, we've got a picture of the beers that we were due to share that night. Yeah, it was quite funny. Lucy had them down her top to warm up, opened the lid of one of them, and immediately it turned into an ice fountain. And we kind of went, "Whoa, that's cool, but annoying. Can't really drink our beer now." And so then we thought we'd do the same with the other one. Like, of course, the same was going to happen. But that was our chilly ride. Lucy went home. I departed across the Atlantic for the row to end all rows, as I imagined it. So packing up in happy socks, excited to be nearly home. Home is just across the water now. But equally sort of thinking, well, it's still the Atlantic, it's still quite big. And it certainly ended up that way. So I left Chatham in the middle of May, Chatham, Cape Cod, expecting it would take me 3 or 4 months to get home. It turned out to be the row to end all rows for many reasons. The weather was really quite rubbish for a lot of the time. Lots of currents pulling me in the wrong direction. Everybody said, "The Gulf Stream, you'll just whip back on that." And well, no, it doesn't work like that. It's not a conveyor belt, apparently. And there's lots of rough stuff, lots of cold stuff. There was need for a resupply just over halfway because I was taking so long that I was going to run out of food. So a good friend of mine in Canada happened to find some sailors who were sailing back across the Atlantic and could bring me some more food. And they also brought me some flowers, which was really special. The wildlife was amazing out there. I don't like using the word amazing unless stuff is amazing, and this certainly was amazing. Loads of dolphins, loads of sea turtles. I even saw a leatherback turtle, which was as long as this lectern desk thing here. And leatherback turtles, they're huge and brilliant, so that was exciting. I saw lots of rubbish too, unfortunately. I took samples, liter samples of water at different points along the way for an organization called Adventure Scientists. This map here represents all the samples they've had from around the world. The size of each dot is one sample, and the size of each dot relates to the number of plastic pieces, microplastic pieces, in each sample. So you can see that sort of down here, A, there's a lot of sailors out there because it's the trade winds route, but also there's lots of plastic. In my samples, there were 9 samples. There were between 0 and 4 pieces of plastic across all the samples, right down to they told me the color of the different fibers and things. It is frightening how much plastic there is in the ocean. And I think perhaps even more frightening for me is just how much stuff is disposable, considered disposable, single-use sort of plastic items. So that was that. It was day 142, though, when it really became the row to end all rows for me. Lee, my weather router, said that there was a hurricane system down in the Atlantic. It was now recurved to come out to sea and straight over the top of me, Hurricane Joaquin. And this time it was sort of a no-brainer. I say sort of a no-brainer to get out, but it did take me a moment of considering whether I should get out or stay there. But Lee said it will be worse than the Pacific. And so within 5 hours of having that phone call, I found myself getting onto this big boat here, which is a 200-metre long carrier vessel that was travelling across the Atlantic. For my part, in the wrong direction. It was going to Canada. But I was safe. I was safe. That was the main thing. It was gutting, however, to watch them cut my boat, Happy Socks, away and watch her drift out over the waves. They couldn't take her on board. It didn't work out. So coming home, a few people said, "Are you going to go back out? Get another boat? Have another go?" No. Maybe my 24-year-old self would have been more indignant about yes, but I think the journey's taught me that it's not just about joining up the dots. It's about the experience. It's about the journey. We'd ticked the goals. I'd had an amazing adventure. I'd shared it with thousands of kids. We'd raised 50 grand for charity. So I said, well, what we're going to do is do the rest of the journey as we would have done in the UK. So from Falmouth in Cornwall to Oxford, we cycled. From Oxford to London, we kayaked, arriving under Tower Bridge on November the 3rd, having the most incredible moment spraying champagne. If you've never done that, I can recommend it because it's super fun. And it's quite cheesy to say, but this picture does sum it up for me in that, okay, I'm the one that gets to do the crazy fun bit, but all of those bits of spray flying out, all of those bubbles, represent all of the people that helped make that happen. Helped me get away safely, helped me come home safely, helped me get away safely again and come home, and so on. The strangers who will never know what part they played in the journey. My team who selflessly and amazingly supported me through all the crazy, I was going to say shitstorms, you know, naughty word, all the crazy stuff and all the good stuff. It was a team effort to make that happen. Now, in January this year, I received a call. "I think we've got your boat." Happy Socks was doing it on her own. Happy Socks had been saved by the wonderful RNLI just 50 metres from the rocks of Southern Ireland. How cool is that? So all those storms through the winter, Abigail, Bertie, Charlie, Desmond, whatever, that were not so good for mainland UK, had helped my little white boat home. We went to pick her up, and she's now been sold on to another rower who wants to row across the North Pacific. So that is very special. I'm going to finish with a couple of slides about how that happened. I know I've told you about logistically how stuff happened. Bits of kit get sent around the world to meet up with me. People help me do it. Sponsors help me pay for it. But how? How? Well, having a brilliant team, one that's willing to adapt and change and roll the highs and the lows, that's important. Having a positive attitude. If you can have a positive attitude more than you can have a negative defeatist attitude, that's going to help you out. So on this day out on the ocean, I had a new toothbrush. It wasn't moldy. It's all about the small things. It's about perspective. There's no point going around in circles forever. Sometimes you have to make change. Sometimes you're forced to make change. You've got to know yourself. You've got to know your chimp, in my case. And I think most of all, nothing ever happens without being a bit like Gao, without saying, "I'm going to do this." We've all got dreams and hopes and all those things, but often they stay as dreams and hopes because we don't say, "I'm going to do that." And I think as soon as you say, "I'm going to do that," you're a bit closer to getting there, and you're more convinced to sort of go and make it happen. So they're my little bits of stuff that I learned on the way, that kind of thing. Oh, that question again. What's next? Well, I've written, I was going to say the adult version of the book, it's not naughty, but you know, I've written written the version of the version of the story. I want to write a kid's version. I want to make a film of the journey. Ultimately, though, Lucy and I want to set up an adventure farm where we get kids outside having little adventures, learning about farming and food and production, and just spending more time outside. So that is all of that. I know I've spoken forever. I'm really sorry.
It's okay. Very, very interesting.
There we go. Thank you, folks.
Sarah, thank you so much for a fascinating talk. I think that I could have gone on listening to you forever. Unfortunately, this event is only sort of set to go on till 8 o'clock.
Sorry about that.
So we have some time for questions from the audience. This is your opportunity to put questions to Sarah. I would ask in speaking that you state your name and affiliation, and we have some roving mics around, should anyone. I think there's a lady there in the audience.
Is that question time?
Yes.
Brooke.
The audience there.
Hello. Thank you very much for the talk. It's really interesting to hear. 4.5 years is an awful long time.
I know.
How did you maintain sort of, I know everyone's very involved, but friendships and your relationship, was that for the whole period as well? It's such a long time to be away from the UK. Mm. How did you manage all that?
So the question to summarise is 4.5 years is a very long time. Agreed. How did I manage to maintain relationships and friendships during that time? It's really interesting. When I first set out and sort of on that first journey across the Indian Ocean, people say, what do you miss? Do you miss your family? And I say, well, I can speak to them or email them. That's fine. I miss my dog because I can't explain to the dog where I am. But maybe it's a getting older thing that you realize just the importance even more of family and friends. And it was reasonably early in the journey, I think, when I thought, I'd really love someone to share this with, like, ready to settle down almost. And I met Lucy when I was home from the Pacific that first time around. Ironic timing, about to go away again for a year and a half. Bloody hell. It worked for us, I suppose, because we just loved each other so much. We knew we were committed to each other. And I think actually we found strength in being apart, but being apart together. So when the only link that you've got is a satellite phone, where there's a delay on the end of it and it might cut out at any moment, it just really makes you listen really hard. And I think, I mean, we hear it all the time, don't we? Communication is so important, but it kind of really is. And for us, it feels like we survived that because we wanted to, but that's given us strength now. It was really hard being away, and I do now really value the time back at home and time to catch up with friends and family. I was really lucky. I had a great satellite communication sponsor in Iridium. And Lucy said Iridium was her favourite sponsor. And I think Iridium was my favourite sponsor too. It allowed us to keep in touch. Yeah. Really long-winded answer, sorry.
Thank you. Lady there with the yellow hat at the back.
Hi, my name's Nadia Ray. I work here in the Gender Institute, so my question will be around gender. So I was wondering if you felt that being read as a woman affected your journey in positive and or negative ways. And also, I was also wondering if you ever had any like spiritual moments like with nature as well, how you would interpret that as spiritual or profound.
Okay. So gender and spirituality. Being a woman, I think there's often a perception that being a woman, a solo woman traveller, is going to be maybe more difficult or more dangerous than maybe being a guy. I don't know statistically if that's true or not. I think my take on it is that occasionally really bad stuff happens to anyone, regardless of whether they're a guy or a girl. I was hassled a bit in Kazakhstan. It felt like in quite a cheeky way, just young guys thinking that because they told me they were very good sex, that somehow I would say yes. It was only in China one night on a back road that I felt threatened by a guy, and okay, probably that's more likely being a woman. I found it was interesting seeing different people's perceptions about gender. In Russia and Kazakhstan, people were surprised that I should be 25 years old, away on my own without a husband. They'd always say, "Where's your husband, Mushna? Are you married?" And I'd point to the bike and say, "That's my husband." And they, you know, were surprised I didn't have kids, because that was the way it was done out there on the whole. And I remember a time in the Midwest in America when a young guy, maybe 12 years old, at a school said, "Has anyone ever told you this is just a guy thing?" And I thought that was really perceptive, because I didn't take it to be, "You're a woman, you shouldn't be doing this." But the messages he's being fed, particularly living in that area where it's super patriarchal, was that it is just a guy thing. You go into any adventure store and there's pictures of sort of men with knives and guns and stuff. And the only place I saw advertising with sort of a woman's face on it, for example, was in the alarm section, personal alarm section, which really annoyed me. I think that's my experience of being a woman, I suppose. Spirituality. Did I ever have any spiritual moments in nature? I think I don't have any religious belief. When people say, "Do you have faith?" or "What did that journey do to your faith?" You know, sometimes it feels like there's an assumption that it would have increased my religious faith and belief. I think it doesn't. It gives you an awareness of yourself, which can give you a faith in yourself or a faith in the order of nature almost, and in the goodness of people. That's how it works for me. I certainly feel, I felt some of my most connected, sort of alive, empowered moments out in nature, maybe. But that's the power and beauty of nature, I guess.
Is there a gentleman there, just by the pillar in the blue?
Thanks. Hi, I'm Terence. I'm an MBA student at London Business School and an amateur adventurist. My question is about the end of your Indian row, actually, which you didn't talk too much about tonight. But I just read your book, Dip in the Ocean, last week, and was taken aback by how that row finished. I wasn't quite prepared for the dramatic ending.
Neither was I.
And, you know, it's amazing how you went from that very traumatic finish to then saying, you know what, I want more of this, and then convincing everyone else that that's a good idea as well.
Yeah.
So I was curious how you went about that transition from getting rescued at the end of your row and then going off for more of it.
Yeah. So Terence is not a plant in the audience, but he did read my other book last week. A Dip in the Ocean, was it, Terence? So anyway, referenced the end of my Indian Ocean row, where I did have an unexpected dip in the ocean. So what happened is that coming into Mauritius, I needed to navigate my way through a narrow entrance in the reef. Saying that out loud now makes that seem as ridiculous as it is in reality. I'd handed over control of the landing to someone I hadn't met before. That was an epic fail. So I didn't know what I was expecting. Someone from my team ended up sort of there in situ before I landed and said, "Ooh, things have become a little different. You need to meet us here." Anyway, it didn't quite happen in the way that we hoped. I ended up getting washed over the reef, capsizing in surf, and sort of boat being bashed up to an extent on the reef. And I had to let off a flare to let the guys waiting for me on land, now dark, know where I was on this reef. And I remember standing there with this massive flare above my head, thinking, "I can't do this again. This is selfish. My mum and my brother are there on shore watching me. That is awful. I'm never going to do this again." But bad stuff doesn't always happen, and you can learn from things that go wrong. And I still maintain that I'm as likely, maybe more than likely, more likely to get knocked off my bike in London or walking out my front door and get squashed than I am out in the middle of the ocean or something like that. And that's how I look at it. Being scared of something is never a good reason not to do it, so long as you're not stupid. And so I think it's on those grounds that I was able to say to family, friends, to sponsors, team, etc., this is what I'm going to do. Yep, that didn't go quite to plan. I was lucky to get out of it, but we've learned from it. Happily, they all said yes.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to take one question from over there, and then we'll come back to you afterwards.
Hello, I'm here.
Hello.
My name's Valerie from UCL. I was thinking between your first voyage, Indian Crossing, and the London to London, technology had really moved on. And, you know, we were following. You were tweeting in the middle of these major storms, and a whole load of people at home were following you. And I wonder how that changed your voyage, really, the fact that, you know, you could really communicate instantly and mm-hmm. consistently, not only with family and friends, but also, you know, with many people following you.
Yep. So the question being about technology and how that moved on, sort of evolved between my first row across the Indian Ocean in 2009 versus setting out in 2011 and then, you know, coming back in 2015. In 2009 on the Indian Ocean, I didn't have a satellite phone sponsor, so I was paying about £1 a minute to be able to upload any emails to phone, to text. That was really expensive. So I limited my phone calls to once a week to my mum, and maybe as a treat once a week to somebody else. So maybe two calls a week unless someone was sort of incoming. And I tried rationing my other communication accordingly. So maybe a send and receive on my emails once a day. I was very lucky on my London to London journey to be sponsored in its entirety for the communication by Iridium. And that meant that there wasn't a cap on my communication capacity, certainly. And I found that that was both great for being able to bring people into the journey, but I guess the downside is that maybe the more you're communicating, the less you're present in what's actually going on. And so at times it was almost a drag in some ways to know that that was there, to know that my sponsors and family and friends knew that was there. And so there was an expectation, partly because I'd said as well, I'm going to share this live, I'm going to make it real. And there's quite a lot of management to do as well of the next stages, the onward stages of the journey. So at times, I sort of just hoped that it wouldn't work for a bit so that I'd have a legitimate reason not to spend time on it. And I'm all for doing things where you don't have immediate access to everything all the time. And certainly there were days when I would choose not to do it, really, as much as possible. But that said, the question about maintaining a relationship, certainly my relationship with Lucy, that was our saviour, wasn't it? To have daily contact where we could speak for a time on the phone. Rhys, my sponsor at the front, is going, oh yeah, we know you spoke. Satellite's been decommissioned since then. Worn out. So yeah, I think that's what I'd say on that one.
We have the gentleman at the back there, please. Like to ask a question.
Hi, my name is Noah. Thank you so much for your time and how much respect that we have for you and your adventure. My question, which is I'm sure everyone here is dying to hear, is what did you study at university and what's your association with the Motor Neuron Disease Charity?
So thank you for your kind words. The question is, what did I study at university? I studied rowing. No, I have a degree in biology. My real interest is marine biology. I went to Oxford, far from the sea. I mean, that wasn't clever. But biology. And then the second question is, what's my association with UCL? LSE. Motor neuron disease. Sorry, not listening. The association with motor neuron disease. Sorry, I didn't explain that in the openers, did I? When I was 21, 22, somewhere around that tender young age, a school friend of mine lost her mum in a really horrible a really horrible sort of run of motor neurone disease that happened very quickly. And I don't think I really knew too much about it before that, except for Stephen Hawking with a form of ALS. And it was through my friend Alex's mum dying and also seeing a campaign run by the MND on the London Tube in probably 2010, which was Patrick the Optimist. He'd been recently diagnosed with motor neurone disease. He was an artist, and he wanted to paint 100 portraits before he could no longer do that with the effects of MND. And I emailed Patrick just to say hi and kind of became friends. And so that's the association, sort of personal links.
Okay. One final question, please. It's now 8 o'clock.
Thanks, Sarah. Martina Ben-Shaul, alumni, and I had the great privilege of riding with Sarah on her penultimate journey for a day. What I observed, I came out there expecting that you had just done this grand journey and we would all fit in and ride with you. And I observed that you were very consensual in your decision-making on the day, really taking everyone's opinion into account, whether to ride a muddy path or take a road. And I would just like to know how you arrived at this state and whether you think that this is a better way of making decisions.
Oh, deep. So, as Martina said, she rode... I didn't know Martina before she turned up in the party bus on the morning of leaving from Bath to Swindon, was it? That's it, something like that. And so I'd put out an open invite to say, people, come and join me on the ride, if you like. Martina had taken that up. How did I make decisions? How did I arrive at that state of, in those final days of the journey, making decisions, sort of group decisions? I was really conscious that it would be a shared experience, as much as it could be, along that final bit of the journey. And I was conscious that my comfort zones or what I'm happy to do with my bike or not might be different to someone else. I mean, I've got a cart horse of a bike that weighs 16 kilos. Lars was on a little skinny racing bike that, you know, weighed a few kilos. So I didn't want to put anyone out of their, I guess kind of, out of their comfort zone or do anything they weren't happy about doing with their bike. I wanted everyone to have a positive experience. And so to me, it is that when you're in a group on a journey, you've got this sort of shared ownership of it, and therefore you should all have a go at making decisions together. I've been on journeys before where it hasn't been like that, and it's been really uncomfortable or it's been really difficult and it's left people feeling alienated. So I think it's really important to be as collaborative and democratic about things as possible. Yeah. Okay.
Well, we're a few minutes past 8 o'clock, so I'd like to bring this evening's event to a close. It's been really inspiring for me, and I'm sure for the audience as well. So thank you very much, Sarah, for...